The low winter sun flickered through our windows and the dog snoozed to the right of my chair. I saw it and felt it. I noticed. My son read on the couch and my daughter practiced piano, her high, steady voice broadcasting her lack of cynicism, her not weary as the damn rest of usness. I heard it. As I worked, I continued to listen, headphones off and down at my side for a change. I listened to the humming and piano playing and dog snoring. And all that quiet, stuffed so sneakily into the gaps. At one point they would switch. It would be my son's turn to practice piano and then the sax. Then she'd read in his spot. The dog would wake up and need to go for a walk. Soup was for lunch and my first deadline would be met. One kid out the door later that afternoon for play rehearsal, and the other undoubtedly hunched over Legos in his room for longer than feels good on his tall, curved, still-growing back. Just as, inevitably, things would fall apart, too. They would fight or get too silly too fast, and one of them would end up mad or being slapped or doing the slapping. Someone would get an elbow accidentally to the stomach or ear and all hell would break loose. There would be trouble and separation, as always. But I knew my husband would be home early to jump in. I'd meet my next deadline, and we would get to the end of that day. No major highs, no major lows. Yet it would feel like the greatest gift. To have just a day, one day to feel it unfold. To really see it instead of sprint past it, checking things off as I went. As I get older and more people are lost to me, I'm beginning to absorb that an uneventful day is a very good day indeed. The doing, the shuffling and shuttling, the eating and sleeping, and yeah, the fighting too. This is life. Together. I listen to the crows caw outside my window, and the squirrels remind me there's no rest for the weary. I can hear the dryer in the basement tumbling, and why that's comforting I'm not sure, but it is. This is what life is, for now. Still so much to do. Still so much left undone. Dear stay-at-home moms and working moms, you're both right. For the past 8 years, I've lived in the middle ground between two categories of mothering. Of course, reducing all of mothering to two opposing sides is such an American thing to do, isn't it? To make it a catfight wrapped in an apple pie. As mothers, we are fed a steady diet of panic-inducing or choice-affirming headlines. We're told just as many studies support staying at home full-time as support mothers working outside the home. We are pitted against one another at every turn, whether it's in culture, in hot takes, or in our own neighborhoods and classrooms. What working mother hasn't been asked to join the other moms for coffee after drop-off and had to answer, "I'd love to, but I actually have to go to work"? And what stay-at-home mom hasn't been treated like the daycare backup on snow days because, you know, she's already at home? But the truth is less shrill than the headlines, comment sections, Facebook, and occasional in-person frictions would have us believe. I spent my first 5 years of motherhood as a full-time, working-in-an-office mom. I worked anywhere from 35 to 60-hour weeks, sometimes more. In my last year of that job, my kids were just under 3 and 5 years old. I worked longer days than I had before they were born. It was unsustainable and insane. During one memorable stretch, I was working every weekend, trying to fit 3 months of work into two. With the exception of sleeping and eating breakfast, I spent an entire Memorial Day weekend at work, on Saturday pausing to watch the Vermont City Marathon go past our building. I missed fresh air. During those weeks upon weeks, I would go home for dinner and then turn around and go back to the studio until 11 o'clock or sometimes midnight or 1 in the morning. One night, my daughter, 3 years old, her face framed by curls, marched over to me as I put my coat on to go back to work. Without a word, she tugged on my sleeves and tried to unbutton the one button she could reach. She must have thought if I didn't have my coat on, then I certainly wouldn't be able to leave. When we come home, we take off our coats. We kick off our boots. We stay a while. When I told her I had to go, her eyes welled up with tears. She crumbled. She had had enough of me leaving every night, every weekend, coming home late, leaving early. And so had I. I was giving my entire life over to this place while my daughter cried and tugged, wanting me home. Naturally, she has absolutely no memory of that moment. Suffice it to say, it's branded onto me for life. I was laid off when the economy crashed, just 6 months before my oldest child was to start kindergarten. I was fortunate to transition quickly into freelancing. And since then, I've had the kind of schedule that allows me to be the one dropping the kids off at school and picking them up. The rare working mother in a pack of stay-at-home moms who are present for the afternoon bell. I can attend morning poetry readings, be there for field trips and performances, or take them to appointments without sacrificing vacation time or having to lie about my whereabouts, something that, for the record, I used to do regularly and without guilt. I have been a mother double agent, straddling these worlds and passing seamlessly between the two for the past 8 years. And it's given me some perspective on how both sides get it wrong and right. Yes, working mom, you have missed fresh from a nap rosy cheeks and spontaneous smiles. But you have also missed another human crapping straight up your arm. You have missed the shapelessness of time, given your calendar is parceled out into 15-minute chunks. But you've also missed the tedious minutes and hours that parenting young children can sometimes, always, entail. Yes, stay-at-home mom, you have missed jumping in the shower first thing in the morning without a lot of little feet and hands and eyes interrupting or hustling you out. But you have also missed excruciating conference calls where 12 people try to talk all at the same time. And then everyone stops talking at the same time, and 55 minutes later you think, someone else is taking care of my baby so I can do this shit? Yes, working mom, you have missed a first. I know you have. Every one of us has. Maybe it was your baby rolling over or sitting up, or the very worst, taking his first step or full-on walking. It is a gut punch, no question. But along the way, you have probably dodged a bullet or two or a half dozen on the colic or the crankiness, the teething or earache front. Yes, stay-at-home mom, you have missed sitting around with coworkers, shooting the shit or belaboring lunch plans for later that day. Lunch with adults. You have missed stringing your thoughts together and having them stay that way without someone tugging at your shirt or your hand to come, come now and do this thing. But you have also missed the mind-numbing tasks, the manufactured chaos, and the never-ending client dinners that have taken you away from your family. You have missed the things that would make you feel better about your decision being the right one. Or maybe actually you haven't. I have seen every mother question her choices. There is working mom guilt and stay-at-home mom guilt because there is enough guilt to go around for each and every mother in this country. And that's assuming you even had a choice. I didn't feel I had a choice as the breadwinner for our family, but I also really liked my job. I was certainly lucky. For so many mothers, the choice isn't whether to work, but it's how many jobs to get. It's how to keep everyone's heads above water. I can only speak from my own experience. And what I know is, when I was a working outside-the-home mother with much more on my plate than I have now, I did a better job of parenting in many ways, and a worse job in others. One small thing that stands out to me is how I used to make pancakes almost every Saturday morning. I felt so guilty over how rushed our weekday mornings were, all of us shoveling cereal in our faces with one foot out the door. And now, while I have no fixed schedule and certainly have my weekends free, it takes a sleepover to get me to deal with pancakes. Pancakes? Is there anything easier than pancakes? I'm not sure there is. And I know since I started working from home, I have patted myself on the back for spending so much time in the same room as my kids, while rarely questioning whether I was actually present. Freelancers don't have scheduled work days or even a scheduled anything. I'm often on my laptop on a Saturday morning, a Friday night, and most afternoons when they get home from school. So is that better than working away from them, where I could often keep work somewhat contained? Debatable, isn't it? Back then, before leaving on a work trip, I would create some sort of token for my kids. Behind these gestures was a timeless combination of working mom guilt, along with the old, well, if the plane goes down, because I like to be optimistic like that. Recently, I came across a booklet I had made for them before I left for a shoot. I reused old envelopes from our studio's mailroom for the pages and printed out photos of us together, of me separately, and of the places and things I might see. I stayed up late taping it all together and binding it with a ribbon, Also, it would be ready to leave on the kitchen counter early the next morning. As I flipped through it all these years later, I was stunned at the amount of effort it took to pull this thing together, especially given I had undoubtedly had a very long day before I got to work on it. I did this at a time when I was getting little sleep, was exponentially stressed, and had almost no time to myself that wasn't work-related. I thought about how I would never do that now, now that I controlled my schedule and could make 5 books a day if I wanted to. I was in awe of former me. Not because I did anything perfectly, but because I truly didn't see what a great job I was already doing. At the time, I felt nothing could make up for my absence, and I also knew that behind these efforts were a raft of apologies. I'm sorry I'm away from you. I'm sorry I have to make money, even though sometimes what I'm doing is stupid and utterly pointless. But also, I'm sorry that I'm probably really enjoying at least part of it. Stay-at-home moms, working moms, all moms, we are allowed to be proud of our choices and to question them, sometimes all in the same day. We have all missed things we wished we hadn't and been present for things so soul-deadening it's a miracle we ever get out of this thing alive. We have all been left so adrift by our society, our culture, and our government when it comes to the first 5 or 6 years of a child's life. We are left to sort it out for ourselves, to cobble together our individual plans. No wonder we take all of this so personally. If you don't believe me, ask yourself the last time parents were shamed for sending their kids off to elementary school. Why would they be? There is a societal and governmental expectation that all children should attend school, that education is necessary for a child's development, and that schools play a critical role in any community. School has our support. Imagine if there was a societal and governmental expectation that all children should attend a quality preschool or daycare program. Imagine the freedom and peace of mind it could offer all mothers, stay at home and working outside the home alike. Imagine. Instead, we are held hostage by hysterical pronouncements and blood pressure spiking headlines. Have you ever told someone your child is in daycare? It's an awful word. It's a hard one to get out. It's where babies go to die on their first day. That's the only time we hear about those places. I hated telling people my kids were in daycare because there was always a look, that look, that said, "I'm sorry you don't love your baby enough to stay home with her." Sometimes I'd get one of those exaggerated, jutted out bottom lip numbers that all but said, "Aw, you know that's just wrong, right?" Or consider the phrase, stay-at-home mom. Maybe the house as a home base was accurate 4 decades ago, but I'm pretty sure I spend more time in my house than stay-at-home mothers do. How does it feel introducing yourself at a cocktail party with that title, surrounded by professional whatevers? Americans do like their ambition, and staying at home with young children is the opposite of ambitious, isn't it? Just tell that to a mother who is on hour 14 with a partner out of town, 2 kids under 3, a dog who just ate half a birthday cake, and bills that need paying. At least when you work outside the home, you have the option of actually leaving work. I have liked this middle ground I've been in. I'm incredibly fortunate to have experienced it. And it has underlined, more than any other experience, how we are our own worst enemies and our very harshest critics. We hold ourselves to intense and impossible standards. We, of course, don't do this alone. Our culture has set the bar so high that it's hidden in a place where we'll never find it. And conversely, the bar for fathers has been set so low, they can easily step over it on the way to the bathroom. But please believe me when I say we aren't making nearly the amount of life-altering mistakes we think we're making, and we are doing an exponentially better job than we can even comprehend. We are in it deep. We are wrong and we are right, regardless of what side we're on. We are human, and we're doing the best we can. Can we not, just for a moment, save a little charity, a smidge of empathy, a bit of softness of the kind we would extend to our kids, and extend it, just this once, maybe a bit each day, to ourselves? Time out. Just what I wanted. A whole 24 hours of recognition once a year. What's this? One single, solitary day of recognition on an annual basis? Wow, it's like you can read my mind. It's exactly what I wanted for Mother's Day. Back when I was 13 months pregnant and my crotch felt like an inside-out cheeseburger solely held together by gigantic cotton underpants, I thought, maybe, just maybe, there could be a whole 24 hours of half-assed thanking in this for me. And again, when my nipples were cracked and bleeding and I had to remind myself, it's not okay to think about wanting to slap my infant daughter to the ground when she approached my naked, vulnerable breasts with her gaping, gummy vice grip born of the River Styx, I knew it would all be worthwhile if just once a year I could get a handmade napkin card that had been hurriedly scribbled that same morning. And most recently, as I sat through yet another school team meeting where I had to really commit to not blurting out, "Jesus, kid, just learn a trade," to try to bring all meetings forever to a real and final conclusion, I thought, if I could just feel mandatorily appreciated for no more than a day, and in all likelihood about 2.5 hours max, all of these exchanges with incompetent school administrators, humorless hard-ass teachers, and genuinely helpful and lovely people who are having their love of working with children slowly drained out of them by the system, it will all have been worth it. And here we are. What day is Mother's Day again? A Sunday? You mean a day everyone else has off anyway? Of course. Perfect. So let me see if I've got this straight. You're saying that me, a mother, will have the same hours of national recognition also afforded bobbleheads, lumpy rugs, personal trainer awareness, spaghetti, one-hit wonders, baked Alaska, hole in my bucket, cellophane tape, home warranties, something on a stick, spiral glazed ham, beer can appreciation, cabbage, cheese doodles, and earmuffs? Someone pinch me. Next, you'll tell me my personal reward for mentally keeping track of roughly 1,000 food dislikes, dentist appointments, classmate birthday parties, bike helmets, other mothers to avoid, weather-appropriate footwear, and snacks to bring to school for whatever the hell they're celebrating this week. We'll be forcing some kind of garbage smoothie and a charred heel of bread past my involuntarily pursed lips with a, good, while noticing that the tulip on my breakfast tray bears a striking resemblance to one of only 2 tulips the squirrels managed to not take out, goddammit. And I have to smile because these photos are definitely going on Facebook? And to not gag over that smoothie because honestly, I think there might be canned dog food in it? Or not lose my shit, even a little bit, over that tulip? Wow, this really is some kind of a day, isn't it? Couldn't I just lock my bedroom door from the inside, smash my phone, and sleep in instead? No, don't worry. I get it. If I complain or don't well up with crocodile tears over the meager slash contractually bound efforts of my family, then I am a selfish monster who should be grateful to have ever experienced the sublime and life-affirming joys of motherhood that are myriad, ceaseless, and without parallel in the human experience. And if I dare to gripe even the tiniest bit, it must always, always be immediately neutralized with some kind of pat statement like, "But it's all so worth it," said through an unnaturally tight smile and with the dissociative stare of a hostage. Oh, those aren't my words. That's actually page 3 of the papers I had to sign before they'd release me from the maternity ward. I'm trying to think what could really put this whole thing right over the top, though. Maybe something about a culture that superficially worships at the altar of motherhood while simultaneously not offering any genuine support or respect. Just a whole lot of soft-focus commercials, bad jeans, and sexless minivans? Man, that's good. Or maybe that same culture could also simultaneously shame mothers who pay too much attention to their kids while also screeching, "Where was the mother?" every time a child so much as gets a wayward mayfly right to the eyeball while enjoying more than 5 seconds of unsupervised outdoor freedom. Or here's another one. Maybe businesses could just decide for themselves what sort of maternity leave they feel like offering, because if capitalism has taught us anything, it's that self-serving empathy should always be used as a recruiting tool. A recruiting tool for people who are already pretty rich to begin with. I'd like that last one worked onto a Hallmark card bordered with roses and white doves, please. Anyway, I want to thank you all for thanking me on this day of required thanking. Now everyone go outside and play so I can throw up this smoothie and clean the kitchen in peace. If Mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. Revised and expanded. If Mama ain't drinking coffee and it's before 8 a.m., ain't nobody need to be talking to her / me. If Mama ain't getting paid family leave, ain't nobody need to be wondering where she lives because it obviously ain't Sweden. If Mama ain't called something other than Mama by total strangers, ain't nobody gonna be getting a smile back. Not happening. If Mama ain't getting mad or sad about something, ain't nobody gotta wonder if she's stuffing it all down because, oh boy, is she. If Mama ain't making some mistakes, ain't nobody think that's actually true, do they? If Mama ain't getting some sort of support after this baby is born, ain't nobody gonna be getting a sibling. If Mama ain't making the same amount of money for the same job as a man, ain't nobody gonna be hearing the end of it, that's for damn sure. If Mama ain't given some sort of heads up to throw on a nice dress and some lipstick the night that she's thrown a surprise birthday party, ain't nobody gonna be liking any of the surprises that come next. If Mama ain't starting a mommy blog, ain't nobody else need to be starting a mommy blog. All full up, ladies. If Mama ain't fitting into her pants, ain't nobody need to be stating the obvious at least to her face, seriously. Use your head on this one, guys. If Mama ain't got a job outside the home, ain't nobody gotta say something just plain D-U-M-B like, I'm so happy I returned to work where I can use my brain again. If Mama ain't a stay-at-home mama, ain't nobody gotta say something just plain mean like, why did you have kids if you're not gonna raise them? If Mama ain't asking you for some parenting advice, ain't no reason to shoot your fool mouth off, internet. If Mama ain't enjoying every minute, ain't nobody need to ask her why unless they really want to hear the answers. If Mama ain't loading the dishwasher, ain't nobody gotta leave their dishes on the table as if the only passable bridge between these two mysterious places are middle-aged lady hands. If Mama ain't told you 121 times to pick up your socks, ain't nobody gotta wonder why, because chances are she's probably dead. If Mama ain't yelling and instead is very, very sing-songy, ain't nobody getting out of this one alive. If Mama ain't breastfeeding, ain't nobody's damn business why or why not. Zip it. If Mama ain't having it all, ain't nobody having it all. Seriously, it's not even an actual thing. If Mama ain't out of ice cream, ain't nobody need to wonder if there's late bedtime tonight. There is not. Go to bed now. I have ice cream to eat. If Mama ain't running for political office, ain't nobody need to worry because she'll still go ahead and fix the world all by herself just like she does every other thing. If Mama ain't feeling completely fulfilled, heard, relaxed, and respected, ain't nobody... Ha ha ha. Sorry. Couldn't even get through that one with a straight face. Vows. Tiny losses. It was a group lunch, a lunch that included my friends and work partners, ex-co-workers, and my husband. We would all meet up after my appointment, although no one besides John and I would know I had an appointment that day. Not at first, anyway. I anticipated that morning with torturous glee, the kind of glee that comes from secrecy and surprises. I had been told there was no need to come in before the 12th week, so I waited and ingested vitamins and daydreamed. This is only the beginning, I told myself. No need to rush. I marked off the days on the calendar as we inched toward our first milestone as a family. A family! What a phrase! I thought, this is probably the only time I'll ever be excited to go to a hospital. I had taken a pregnancy test and another one. Positive and positive. I had taken one in the doctor's office. Positive again. I mean, how pregnant can you get? I felt the effects, the hangover-like effects that even a good nap and an entire box of mac and cheese can't kill. I had felt sleepy and sore and full of questions. Only John and I knew I was pregnant. Otherwise, I didn't tell another soul. Not a best friend, not my business partners, not even a stranger, which would have been the safest option. I knew the miscarriage statistics by heart, that 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 pregnancies are lost before the magic 12-week mark. I rationalized that if something terrible did happen, no one would be the wiser. I was pregnant. Then I wasn't. I would go about my life as if I had just had a bad cold. But let's face it, that wasn't going to happen. Even with my naturally pessimistic nature, some part of me believed I'd be firmly on the other side of those statistics. The 3 out of 4, the 4 out of 5. Just before I reached that 3-month mark, I felt better. Measurably, incredibly, joyfully better. Just like the books and websites and articles said I might. I marveled at how well it was all working out. I felt completely relieved of the soreness and the nausea. I'd be able to eat a meal with my friends without lurching from the variety of smells and meats and sauces. I wouldn't have to keep secrets anymore either, which was exhausting in its own way. It would all be out there, finally. I hate surprises. But I like surprising people. And a pregnancy is always the best kind of surprise when you're married and in your 30s. And although you weren't ready and you weren't trying, you also weren't not trying. These things happen, and holy shit! I thought about how after all that waiting and keeping my mouth shut and acting like I wasn't about to fall asleep or throw up in my purse, I'd finally spring this big announcement at lunch, and what would it all mean? I guess we'd hug or squeal, and I'd talk about my due date, and maybe I'd even share the name I had in mind. Sawyer, whether it was a boy or a girl. Although, I admit it only to myself, it'd be especially fantastic for a girl. Sawyer Hughes. That is a girl who is going places. That is a girl who will bruise hearts and helm companies. That is a girl who will break big stories, own big dogs, and have her own place in the city and maybe another one in the country. Nothing fancy. A cottage of some sort. And that is a girl who will have me in her corner. Always. Or maybe, just maybe, that will be a girl who will never exist. The gel was applied to my belly and the wand worked its way around. It searched, and searched, and searched, and searched. Because this was my first ultrasound ever, I was just the kind of happy idiot who didn't know anything might be wrong. Besides, today was the day of sharing great news and us all eating lunch together. Nothing bad happens on a group lunch day, does it? I waited anxiously for the doctor to come in. Let's get a real expert in here who knows what she's doing. Who knows, maybe heartbeats are hard to find. We waited for the right answer. "I'm so sorry," is what we got instead. What we finally saw, as she held the wand still, was a small, gray jelly bean resting on its side at the bottom of my uterus, like a stone in an empty bucket. Nothing to see here. We both started to cry. I was informed of my options. I could wait it out and miscarry naturally, or I could get a D&C. Fuck waiting it out. I want this out of me. What a thing it is, to go about your life carefully for weeks and months, everything in protection of this little life, imagining this little thumbnail of a thing as a boy, as a girl, with wavy hair, with blue eyes, with limbs and thoughts, growing up, getting married. The brain is a fantasy machine, and it will spin out entire biographies for a clump of cells you hadn't even confirmed were actually alive. What a thing. To go suddenly from that imagined, endless future to straight down into a dark, visceral place where you just want your dead baby gone. Out of you. If you're not alive, well, let's just get on with it then. We were sent to another waiting room, another nurse, to make an appointment. I walked in a fog, my puffy, sad face not at all out of place in the infertility clinic. Jesus. Was I infertile now? I feel like OBGYNs don't really understand how triggering their practices are. Their waiting rooms, their signage, their mix of patients who are at opposite ends of major life experiences. It'd be like having an oncologist who only specializes in people definitely dying of cancer and people who will never get cancer, guaranteed. But please, wait in this room together so you may see your lives in stark relief. We sat down. This was not happening. I sent an email to everyone about lunch. I wasn't feeling well and I was so sorry, but even though I organized this whole thing, I wouldn't be able to make it. I used an appropriate number of exclamation points. They didn't know what they didn't know. I was just sick, just like I had planned. I just can't make it. I'm so sorry. Throwing up, you know. No one needs that at their lunch, right? ! The morning of my DNC, we made our sad, slow way to the hospital. This was not what I had planned for that Friday. Earlier that week, Friday was simply one more step forward in our future together. One in a series of neat, predictable steps you took once you were married. From wedding to honeymoon to buffer period to babies. And now we were moving backward. We were going to need to wait to be ready to start all over again. Waiting to be ready to start. This was stupid. I had never had any kind of procedure before. I never broke an arm or a leg or had the most minor of surgeries. Unless you count having wisdom teeth taken out. Which I do not. This was my first hospital bed. My first IV. And don't those hurt like a motherfucker? My first signing of documents legally warning me that I could die due to complications from general anesthesia. Sounds great right about now, give me the pen. And my first maneuvering of a complicated bed. What a beautiful room it was, with windows that looked out at the appropriately gray city of Portland, Oregon. What a beautiful place it would be to have a baby, I thought. Instead, it felt quiet and awful. My doctor came in to check on me before the procedure. I had tried hard to keep it together, but then she sat on the edge of my bed. Up until that moment, she had always been professional and reserved. At every exam, she had taken on the role of annual fertility alarm, asking me if we were considering starting a family. She could sense how cavalier I was being, so she always left me with a gentle, "Just don't put it off too long. It will only get more difficult." But in this moment, we were on the same side. Sure, I hadn't tried to get pregnant, but that's exactly what I had done. And then I was not. She quietly but directly began. "I had a miscarriage with my first pregnancy. I really do understand how you're feeling right now. But I want you to know I went on to have two healthy kids. You will get pregnant again." She paused. "This just wasn't the right time." The thing was, it really wasn't the right time. We had told each other it wasn't the right time. We were broke, and only getting more broke by the day. The design studio I was a partner in was tanking. Everything was tanking, from the fallout of September 11th. We were in massive debt. When I came across a vintage toy Winnebago camper at a yard sale for $20, I bought it as a symbol of this time in our lives when we were clearly going to end up living in a van down by the river. It was a symbol we had nothing, that we actually had less than nothing, that we owed everyone. And it was a symbol of my own idiocy, that even when we were poorer than dirt, I'd still spend my last $20 on a toy camper. My confidence that my partners and I would sashay into the design world and start making money hand over fist led to ridiculous anticipatory spending and no safety nets. And now I was pregnant. Or I had been pregnant. But we would have made it work had the baby stayed. Had we stayed. Everyone always makes it work. Don't they? I couldn't summon my voice. Tears slipped across my cheeks, and I nodded my head to indicate I had heard her. That I hoped, that I wanted to believe what she was saying was true. John squeezed my hand. I cried harder. And then I was out. And then it was done. And we were back to not being a family again. That weekend was an unseasonably beautiful one. It was early May in Oregon, a place where we could usually count on the gray skies and rain enveloping us well past the 4th of July. I parked myself in the sun in our backyard, drinking beer and smoking cigarettes. After being gentle with my body for so long, I now set out to poison it. Fuck you, body. I wanted to get numb and stay there. It's incredible to realize now there were no iPhones, no social media, no Facebook. Otherwise I would have been numbing myself with those, too. Instead, I let the sun beat down on me and allowed a slow, imprecise level of drunkenness to take over. I miss how we used to all have to feel our feelings while we were feeling them, alcohol aside. Now I can't get through writing a slightly challenging sentence without a 35-minute distraction-laced journey through at least 3 social media platforms. Sometimes 5. I tried to read, but everything I picked up would either not hold my interest, and the last thing I needed was my mind to wander, or incite rage. There are mothers everywhere, and pregnancy, and relationships, and siblings. There are babies. Alive ones. I can still feel the heat of that sun on my face. I can see our patchy backyard, the one our dogs had thoroughly destroyed through their Kentucky Derby-like treatment of it. When we had first moved in, there were banks of lavender and mint all around our low-slung deck. After a few months, a clutch of hardy sprigs clung on for their lives. The rest turned to hard-packed dirt. The dogs were soaking in the sun, too, occasionally rising to sniff at me, then collapse back into their comas. I turned this way and that, having fully surrendered. I didn't know what to do with myself, given that what had been filling me emotionally and physically was now gone. I begged the sun to bake the sadness out of me. After just a day, and much to my disappointment, I realized I needed to tell people my news. Our news. Trying to process my grief with someone who was also grieving turned out to not be a solid plan. Plus, I think there's nothing quite like drunk dialing your friends in the middle of the day with sad news. I called one of my oldest and dearest friends and told her what had happened, the good news that ended up being the bad news. She was healthy and sane and suggested I take care of myself, maybe go for a walk, or consider yoga once I was up to it, and I was like, yeah, I think I'll just drink and smoke. Thanks, though. I didn't tell many people. I started small and close, as it should be. I told only women at first, because, of course, none of them were mothers, not yet. But I felt like they would know as much as I knew at that point. They would understand the disappointment, although none of us understood what it meant to be a parent. They would be appropriately sad for me, and I needed some extra hands on the being sad for me front. Mine were all filled up. I napped and drifted. I went to bed early and late. It's strange to have your calendar suddenly wiped clean. That Sunday I woke in the dark, starving. I needed coffee. I needed brain alterations that were decidedly more morning-friendly. I left the house in search of donuts at 5:30 a.m. I had lived on the West Coast long enough to know there would be no Dunkin' Donuts every five blocks, and even if there were, no one would care. Poor Dunkin' Donuts. I drove around trying to find any place that was open, finally landing at a supermarket 10 miles away. I beelined it for the bakery and filled a waxed paper bag with chocolate-covered donuts with sprinkles. The same donuts I would always get when I was a kid, after I washed my dad's car on Saturday mornings, and we'd head to the donut shop as a reward. I wondered what kind of donuts my kids would want. I wondered if I could even have kids. Maybe I couldn't. Maybe that was my one shot. As I waited in line to check out, a great cosmic joke played out all around me. Mother's Day. It was fucking Mother's Day. Are you serious? I guess all that numbing worked, I thought, realizing I had lost track of the days, of the world around me, my calendar no longer having any use, the X's ceasing to appear. I was bleeding uterine tissue into my pants and had a hangover and a bag of donuts, so by all means, pile on. Fuck you, Mylar balloons and garbage roses encased in clear plastic megaphones. Fuck you, the only Mother's Day cards left in this store, awaiting the shittiest kids and husbands of all time on the morning of this holiday. Fuck you, me, for not retaining enough common sense and or sobriety to know not to be out in public today. Fuck you, life. I scurried home as quickly as I could, like a donut-loving vampire, the sun finally rising. Do not let me leave this house today. At all, I told John once he was awake, looking confused. It's Mother's Day. I did not think of myself as a mother. The more people I told, the more I heard, you're still a mother. You'll always be a mother. But I didn't believe that. I didn't believe I had a fully formed angel baby in heaven. I didn't think I had experienced motherhood in any sort of real way, in the kinds of ways that would have made me feel comfortable claiming that title. I hadn't had a baby. I had had a lump of dead cells sucked out of me. Sorry, but that ain't motherhood. We didn't have a ceremony. I never called the baby, was it a baby, by name. I never whispered to myself when no one was around, I'm so sorry, Sawyer. I'm sorry we didn't get to meet you. I never did that. At the same time, the name Sawyer was permanently retired from my list. I wasn't looking for a replacement baby to claim it. So to recap, I didn't feel like a mother, but I had been a mother. And I didn't think there had been a baby, but then I didn't want another baby to have my non-baby's name. Maybe there was a fantastical part of me that believed my imagined future existed, that there was a Sawyer Hughes living the life I had imagined for him or her. I don't know. I just went with how I felt. As a non-mother mother who had lost her non-baby baby. Goodbye, Sawyer Hughes. I wonder who you would have been. That summer slowly unfolded into opposite land. Instead of weeks and months of appointments and salads and vitamins and reading emails with subject lines like, "This is how big your baby is right now," I watched our design studio sink further into the world of no projects and no money. John and I spent hot afternoons lying in a plastic kiddie pool in our backyard drinking beer as I slipped further and further into not giving a fuck about any of it. Nothing felt within my control. Nothing was within my control. Might as well live it up while the ship was going down. And although my heart was black, my brain continued to whir in the background, a hard drive throwing off alarms. That summer kicked off a lifelong sporadic habit of my waking before the sun and just getting up, feeling wide awake. My brain was telling me to get to it, but never what that it was. Regardless, I listened. It was always productive. Some mornings I would pad into my small office to write or read, and other mornings I would simply make a cup of coffee and appreciate the stillness, which was productive in its own way. One memorable morning I picked blackberries from our backyard as the first rays of warm summer sun shot through the clouds. I brought them to our kitchen sink, breathing in their earthy, jammy scent, pulling pancake mix and eggs and milk from cupboard and fridge. Blackberry pancakes for breakfast, ready so early it was like I was fueling up before heading out to milk the cows. John woke up, looked gratefully and alarmingly at the stack of pancakes, and was like, "What is happening?" 15 years later, and that one particular expression of my sleeplessness has never repeated itself. It became apparent that no matter how much I tried to stuff everything down, it would find a way to pop back up. In the middle of the night, in the morning, while eating my lunch, after a single sip of beer. It was always there, gurgling under the surface. I would cry at times and at things that made no sense. But that's grief, isn't it? I needed more structure. I needed more life. I returned to work. I re-entered the world at large, the post-Mother's Day world, then back to our regularly scheduled programming world. It took 2 weeks before I could handle any sort of social gathering. I just hadn't been up to it. Simply going to the Starbucks on the corner was enough of a regular test of my strength, slaloming through strollers and toddlers, pregnant women, and attached infants. Ignore them by picking up a magazine and get ready to be punched in the face with celebrity baby bumps and trending diaper bags. Motherhood and babies are everywhere. They are our stability porn. The days went by. I told more people, if for no other reason than to relieve myself of having to remember who knew and who didn't. The more my supposedly deep, dark secret came out, the more I discovered that apparently having a miscarriage was as common as having the flu. I felt stupid for suffering alone, even for 5 minutes. And I realized, as with all grief, that the people who step up aren't always the ones you expected to or needed to. Sometimes the people you counted on the most are the same ones who will actually say the most hurtful, unbelievable shit imaginable. Sometimes grief ripples out and takes the living with them. Bon voyage, assholes. On the flip side of that are the people who played an indelible role in your teenage years or were a coworker at your previous job or a neighbor you had only traded small talk with. They are the people who live on the fringes of your life, who, when given the opportunity, will inexplicably rush in to fill the vacuum in your heart. The vacuum left by people you loved and respected who said things like, "You can just get pregnant again," or "It's probably all for the best," or "Your grandmother, father, dog, best friend, lived a good, long life. They will fill the vacuum left by people you had counted on to not shit all over your grief. Firmly in this camp was the first boy I had ever parked with. 18 years earlier, there we were, clothes shoved up and down in broad daylight. I remember I had to mentally prepare myself to make out with him. Remember mentally preparing to make out with someone? Now if he turns his head this way, then which way do I turn my head? And even still, I managed to turn my head the mirror way he turned his head. And is there anything more embarrassing than that? Little did I know then that the urge to get your hot little hands and mouth somewhere on someone else will always triumph over even the greatest humiliation. We were never boyfriend and girlfriend. We never had any sort of long-term connection or relationship that would have made sense to revisit or continue. We had gone our own ways early on, while we were still in high school. Him with the stoner, gearhead crowd, and me with a crowd made up of single representatives from every other clique, a high school UN. It was a class of 68 kids, for God's sake. It took real effort to cover all the stereotypes. Like this one over here was a National Honor Society nerd and a jock. Or she was a cheerleader and a theater kid. Regardless. He grew up, not unexpectedly, to be the gruffest, most off-roading, no-bullshit, card-carrying NRA member possible, putting us squarely in epic odd-couple territory. I don't know why us reconnecting after almost 20 years worked as well as it did. Maybe, like any reconnection after that long, it reminds you that you were young. It reminds you that once upon a time you had afternoons free to haul ass on back roads, get half-naked with another person, and still make it home in time for a dinner someone else had prepared for you. It reminds you that you didn't have to pay for your electricity or your house. You didn't have to think about getting married or having kids. You didn't have to think about much at all, really. So when you look at that other person all those years later, you see all of that. You are on those back roads, and you are in that back seat. You are under the lights of the high school parking lot, and you are at that pizza place. You see each other, the way you used to. You see yourself, when you were fresh before life started having its way with you. This man, this boy from my infinite past, was the only person who offered me an out, a free plane ticket home. And I took it. Within a few days, I found myself in the town next to my hometown, 3,000 miles away from my house and my husband and my life, my real life and my imagined one. We sat in a diner built in the 1940s, the kind of place that opens at 5 a.m. and closes at 2 in the afternoon. I had a newfound respect for places that opened early. We wolfed down butter-soaked toast and bright yellow eggs. Coffee came in sturdy mugs, and it never stopped coming. As if this scene made all the sense in the world, me being there with him. As if this was how things were going to start being okay again. But somehow, starting with that morning, they did. That night we drank like fish, the thick summer heat settling in that way it does in New England. And I wasn't in my 30s anymore. Suddenly, I was in high school again. I felt the thrill of all those nights spent aimlessly crawling the spider's web of back roads, listening to night moves as steam rose from the asphalt after a sudden storm. I felt familiar and protected, like maybe I had my whole life in front of me again. I was surrounded by fireflies and thickets of overgrown trees. I had always thought of summer as being light, but there was a certain heaviness to summers here. I was back to working on mysteries without any clues. We went skinny dipping in the lake near his house in the still darkness. I skinny dipped a lot back then. Yes, he had a girlfriend. No, nothing happened. Yes, my husband would know about all of it when I returned. We stayed up until sunrise. I fell asleep on his couch, the sun blasting into my face in between the blinds. I slept until noon and woke with a searing headache, the kind that makes you want to rip your head off and beat yourself to death with it. I wasn't gone for long, maybe 3 or 4 days. But when I returned home to Portland, I was better. I can't explain exactly how or why, but I was. I hated returning to the sadness, but I knew I couldn't avoid it forever. And for the first time, I felt like I wouldn't feel that sadness forever. I was ready for whatever might be next. I had to be. John and I went to a friend's party, A party for what, I don't even know. I guess back then, no one really needed a reason to have a bunch of people over. And I wound up in the kitchen, of course, with two of our only friends who had kids. One of these women, a dear friend of my husband's, had also suffered a miscarriage. The baby she lost would have been her third child. We soaked in our back and forth and our newfound connection, two perspectives from opposite sides of the mothering spectrum. Our experiences simultaneously intermingled and separate, one from the beginning and one from the end. She was a level-headed person, an emotionally in-tune person. She was a mother and a wife. She was smart and empathetic. She was not crazy. She was not woo-woo. So when she told me she had seen a psychic at the urging of her sister-in-law, a psychic who had helped her reconnect with her miscarried baby, and that it helped her, that she believed that the connection was real, that the psychic was the real deal, I listened. She said to me with the honesty and clarity of a good friend, "I'm telling you, it helped. It really made me feel at peace." I left the party with something I wouldn't have believed when we arrived. A psychic's phone number jotted down in pencil. I made an appointment. I set off into the outer reaches of Southeast Portland. The outer reaches. Her office was located in a building that had the feel of an abandoned concrete bunker. There was no signage, and I had to come alone. I couldn't help but wonder, was this the last thing I'd ever do? I had never been to a therapist or talked to any sort of professional or semi-professional or even an amateur about my feelings or my life. I wasn't sure how any of this was supposed to work. Being the natural skeptic that I am, I told her very little about my life because, hello, I'm paying you to be a psychic. Figure out what's wrong with me, please, and tell me what's going to happen next. With one exception, I did tell her about my miscarriage. No need to burn good money over unnecessary mind games. I had to tell her why I was there. It took me a while to settle into what was happening. The whole situation was simultaneously strange, yet hopeful. The more we talked, the more I began to let the strangeness go, and instead open up to the possibilities. I started to understand why people who felt desperate reached out to psychics. It was help beyond help. It was help that broke all the rules. She told me water was a soothing element in my life. I should be seeking out water whenever and wherever I could. Even listening to the sounds of water would work, she said. I had never realized until that moment how central water had been in my life, from Rhode Island beaches to skinny dipping my way across pools in L.A., to the lake I had just returned from. Even for me, a terrifically shitty swimmer, it had the power to make me feel like I was home. I cried, not realizing how much I had been forcing myself to feel normal. Worse than normal. Like a robot. The baby had been a boy, she said. Sawyer was a boy. That it had not been the right time for him. Or for us. She said he was happy and safe, and that he loved us. She said more about him, from him, but it's now lost to my lack of replaying it. A couple of months later, I returned to her one last time, when I had a serious job offer in Vermont. I was now the type of person who was consulting a psychic over a job offer. I couldn't even stand it. We didn't want to leave Portland. It was sickening to even think about. We had always imagined building a family there, taking our baby to the Selwood pool and berry picking with our kids on Sovey Island, roller skating at Oaks Park Roller Rink and going to the Oregon State Fair, even though that thing was awful. But our financial lives were in ruin, and my design partners had left to work at Nike. I wasn't established enough to freelance, and besides, there was no freelance to get, even if I had been. My work world was tanking, and something had to give. Everything else that could already give, our plans, our lives, our hopes, already had. The universe was conspiring to spit us out of a place we loved. That's how it felt. It was going to make us so utterly miserable that we'd have no choice. I told her a little about my job offer and the location. I said I was worried that the job would not only be impossible, that the scope of it seemed crazy, but also that I was more concerned that it would be a step backward. It was similar to a job I had already done and didn't want to do anymore. And although the idea of Vermont was exciting, we had spent time there during our month-long road trip honeymoon and had added it to our list of places we'd like to live someday, but obviously when we were retired, because what jobs could there possibly be? The thought of leaving Portland and Oregon and the West Coast behind was the saddest I had felt since losing the baby. At the end of our session, she said, "Your job will be hard, but it will allow you to do everything you want to do." And she added, "You will have a boy and a girl there. Everything you've ever wanted is there." I left my job. We left Oregon. I sold my 65 Chevy. We left our friends. We brought our dogs. My job was hard. But in ways big and small over many years, and then due to the absence of it entirely, it allowed me to do exactly what I wanted to do. I have a boy. I have a girl. I have everything I've ever wanted. After our first child was born, I put together some photos of him and wrote a letter to my OBGYN in Portland. I told her she was right. It hadn't been the right time then, but it was now. I told her I was a mother and this cute baby right here, this was my son. I thanked her for everything. I thanked her for giving me permission to hope. If you love your grandparents, go visit them. 1. Arrivals. Florida has never been on my list of favorite destinations. Sorry, Florida. But since I moved back to New England, I've embraced the fact that without Florida, the winter ship of sanity would set sail forever and burst into flames on the horizon. I'm a searcher and a ground gazer. So from the very first time I saw pictures of the beaches of Sanibel Island strung with thick garlands of carnival-colored shells, I knew I wanted to go. And I wanted to bring my kids, who only knew the hard-won small sand dollars of Maine or the occasional freshwater snail shell delivered from Lake Champlain. I was hungry for abundance in the dead of winter, for saturated color and steam-soaked air. When we landed at Fort Myers, I was immediately struck by the formations of grandparents dotting the arrival area. Couples, singles, flocks. One with a tentative cane, another with obedient curls, all with the look of permanent tourists. Relaxed, tan, and sporting Florida t-shirts with swoopy beach graphics, their faces bright with expectation. I hadn't thought much about my grandparents while planning this trip. I'd never been to Sanibel Island before, and for all I knew, neither had they. I had never connected my memories of my grandparents and their life in Florida with this trip until that very moment. As soon as I did, my heart felt the way a bruise does when it's newly discovered, tender to the touch, a purplish surprise. I thought of all the times I should have visited them. I thought of all the times it could have been them waiting for me. I thought of all of the trips I could have made happen, but didn't. 2. The rearview mirror. When I was little, we lived in Rhode Island, next door to my maternal grandparents. I rode to nursery school on the back of my grandmother's bike. I played in their garden and plucked the tiniest blue-white flowers from the shaded patch of our mutual yard. And although my family eventually moved to Wisconsin and then to Massachusetts, I spent 2 weeks out of every summer staying with them, just one block from the beach. The details. The indelible details of those days. The way my grandfather rose before the sun, humming to himself and stirring his coffee over and over again. I can still hear the spoon circling around, clanging against the inside of the cup. A meditation. The days were long and free, full of high-stepping, bare feet on searing asphalt walks to the beach, searching for shells and pulling seahorses from fishermen's nets. My friends and I put on fashion shows and plays in the backyard, pinning a sheet to the clothesline for a theater curtain. We baked cupcakes, and I learned how to properly make a bed. I caught tiny jellyfish in a jar and learned how to sew. I ate seedless grapes and a nightly dish of vanilla ice cream and rivers of Cheez-Its. I felt loved and cherished, cared for and fussed over. I never knew how good I had it. Do any of us? Ever? 3. Unforgivable, merciful fate. Their early lives were punctured with loss. My grandmother is a first-generation American and one of nine children. Her mother, my Portuguese great-grandmother, was often a single